security. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for argument this morning is United States against Brown. Mr. Fox.
Mr. Money.
May it please the court, my name is Kevin Fee and I represent appellant Anthony Brown. Your Honors, this case involves a reverse sting set up and orchestrated entirely by the government from beginning to end. In the case of Anthony Brown, the government, through its informant Jacques Polk, sold Mr. Brown a plan to steal money from a car. The government then attempted to piggyback a drug conspiracy onto this theft plan by hiding a nondescript Brown package underneath the bag of money that Mr. Brown was told about. But the evidence presented was not sufficient to show Brown's knowing possession of drugs with intent to distribute, thus warranting reversal of both his drug convictions.
How important is it that Mr. Brown was a police officer? Couldn't the jury infer, for example, that when he saw the brick being taken out of the car, that he understood that it was likely a kilogram of cocaine?
Your Honor, I think, first of all, I don't think that the evidence shows that he saw the brick to begin with. And I think that the fact that he was not given reason to have knowledge that drugs would be present in the first place means that, you know, looking at a sort of nondescript brown package on that he never expected to be there in the first place would not trigger that.
But when you say that he didn't expect to be there in the first place, he did say in advance of the theft that my boy, you know, always gets the dope or some such. Why wasn't it a jury question whether that statement would be enough to impute knowledge of the cocaine to Brown?
Well, I think, Your Honor, when you look at the one errant mention of dope that was uttered in Mr. Brown's presence, it actually does not only does it not fit with the rest of the explanation given to Mr. Brown, it actually is contrary to the rest of the explanation, which suggested an out-of-towner coming into town with money, in fact, looking for drugs, which would suggest that the sort of mystery party that the two men were waiting for was, in fact, the drug supplier rather than the drug buyer. And I think that when you look at the sort of totality of the initial conversation, the errant mention of dope a single time simply is not enough to support a reasonable inference. And I think if you look at the case of U.S. v. Stanley, it supports that just mentioning dope in someone's presence when they have no evidence of any reason for that to have any meaning to the defendant is not enough. I think that given the understanding that was established, or the lack of understanding, rather, that was established on June 24th, simply seeing, or possibly seeing, a flash of Brown in addition to the Brown bag that Mr. Brown expected to be there on the 27th would not have any reason, or would not present Mr. Brown with any reason to suspect that anything other than what he expected, which was a theft of money, was up. Now, if you look, I want to make sure that I cover the initial June 24th conversation because I do think that that's the key to the case. I think that once you establish that Mr. Brown did not have an understanding based on that, that all the other events on the June 27th are colored by that. And I do believe that if you look at the transcript, which is the short appendix, page 17, he is actually specifically told that in the typical transaction, the out-of-towner is coming to town with money looking to get some quantity of drugs, like two keys or whatever, woo-woo. And given that he's actually told that he's coming looking for drugs, I think that there's no reason to suspect that the single errant mention of the word dope is enough. And now, given that, all the events on June 27th are then sort of colored by that. And I do want to get to also my second argument, which is that certainly there was no reasonable inference that Mr. Brown knew that there would be a specific type and quantity of drugs present beyond a reasonable doubt. There was no agreement as to type or quantity.
Why does that matter?
Because
type and quantity are not elements of the offense.
Right, Your Honor, but I think that since the government made them part of the jury's finding by presenting the special verdict form, which asked them to find beyond a reasonable doubt.
My question is, what difference does it make? Since they aren't elements of the offense, whether or not a particular type or quantity has been shown just doesn't matter. if there were a special verdict asking the jury to find what color the drugs were, that wouldn't matter either.
Well, Your Honor, my understanding is that the jury was asked to find those two things beyond a reasonable doubt.
You hear my point. If the jury is asked to find what color are the drugs, and the jury says puce, would it be an available issue on appeal that all the evidence showed that the drugs were orange?
Well, in this case, it had a direct effect on Mr. Brown's sentencing.
That's a different question, right? But the judge makes the findings in sentencing, at least after Booker,
right,
subject to the advisory nature of the guidelines. And we have here, of course, the makings of a Palladino remand.
Right. But the judge was constrained by the jury's finding, specific finding of type and quantity. So the judge could not go below that floor that was established by the jury because of the special verdict form. So the government essentially made sentencing an issue in introducing this before the jury to constrain the judge at sentencing. And that's why I believe that it mattered. Now, finally, I do want to touch on the fact that despite this evidence, which is not sufficient, on top of this very thin case, the government entered this highly prejudicial and irrelevant evidence related to the prior theft of a gold watch while Mr. Brown was a CHA policeman.
Well, doesn't the evidence help to establish Brown's relationship with Polk and also, shed some light on Brown's intent vis-a-vis the conspiracy to steal, from the drug dealer's car?
Your Honor, first, I think that the theft charge was not contested at trial, and both the government and the court were on notice that it would not be contested. So I don't think that it's relevant to anything but that uncontested charge, which makes it makes the probity of it highly doubtful.
Your client didn't plead guilty to that charge, did he?
He did not plead guilty, but he did not offer any meaningful defense at trial.
No,
and he.
But the government is still entitled to prove it. If you don't want the government to prove the elements of a charge, you plead guilty. If you plead not guilty, the government has to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt.
But this
is evidence that helps show that charge.
Your Honor, unlike the cases that the government cited in which a single element was conceded but the rest of the charge was otherwise contested, this was a case where the entire charge was not contested.
No. Your client pleaded not guilty. That contests every element of the charge and requires the prosecutor to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt.
But surely it
can't say the prosecutor can't prove his elements because I was planning not to put on a defense.
But surely it goes to the probity of the evidence, and the weighing of probity versus prejudice goes into each of the evidentiary standards. And given the fact that the jury was not even asked to look at this issue, this highly prejudicial evidence of a theft from the CHA, which has a lot of emotional impact.
Right. If your client wanted to avoid that, he should have pleaded guilty.
I understand. But again, I do think that it goes to the probity, and I think that given the thinness of the evidence, otherwise
you mean probativeness rather than probity.
Probativeness, that's what I mean. Given the thinness of the other evidence, as I've discussed, I think that it had an improper prejudicial effect on the jury. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Fee. Mr. Carlson.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kent Carlson. I'm court-appointed counsel for Jerome Coleman. Most of the argument that I have here is contained in my brief, and Mr. Fee reiterated much of what I said, and I'm not going to repeat what he said here. I would just remind the court that the only evidence that was introduced against Mr. Coleman with respect to his knowledge of whether this was a theft of money or drugs came from the mouth of the confidential informant. The record is clearly devoid of any evidence that Mr. Coleman heard the single comment that was referred to. Certainly, the confidential informant did not admit that Mr. Coleman heard it. On cross-examination, the government witnesses acknowledged he did not respond to the comments in any way. And in fact, all of the conversations which preceded that had to do with theft of money and my client needing money.
Well, I mean, it doesn't the evidence tell us that Polk told Mr. Coleman and Mr. Grady that his guy said there's going to be some coke in there and that it would probably be like a brick?
Judge, that was the sole comment that was made. It was made in a three-way phone call, and my client's responses to that comment do not indicate that he in any way heard that. As a matter of fact, they are contrary to that because my client talks about money.
But the jury can still infer that Mr. Coleman, you know, agreed to help steal the cocaine. I mean...
And, Judge, again, I would, again, as Mr. Fee said, I would cite the Stanley case that the mere mention of that by a confidential informant without more, and in this case there isn't more, is not enough to sustain a conviction here. And I would suggest to the court that the transcript of that conversation is... when you look at that in a vacuum, it seems very clear. I would invite the court to listen to the actual tape recording of that conversation because that tape recording really puts in better context what was actually said throughout this conversation, the quality of the conversation, and I think that really is what puts the whole thing into context. And then the actions of my client afterwards, Judge, are just not such that they show that he had any knowledge that drugs were involved. He was not present when the drugs were found. He wasn't looking for the drugs. And I would just suggest to the court that the evidence, even viewed in the light most favorable to the government, is not sufficient to sustain his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Miller.
May it please the court, Barry Miller for the United States. Mr. Brown is asking the court to look at the evidence in isolation and not take it as a whole, as the court must, in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict.
But, Mr. Miller, what evidence supports the notion that Mr. Brown agreed to steal any particular amount of narcotics here, you know, more than 500 grams of cocaine?
There are a series of factors together that support the jury's verdict, Your Honor. First, there's the discussion that is at tab 20 at 2 to 3, hit the man and somebody got some work or something like two keys or whatever, that he understood that two keys could be present. My boy always gets the dope. That was before the theft. Contrary to the way it's described in counsel's brief, Mr. Polk testified that Mr. Brown was standing there watching the cash and the sham drugs in the trunk as they were removed. And he shouted, "That's it." Mr. Polk testified that Mr. Brown opened the getaway car door so they could put the drugs and the cash in.
Did you say Mr. Brown shouted, "That's it"?
That's at page 24 of our brief.
Yeah.
Mr. Polk testified Brown opened the getaway car door to help them put the stuff in. And later, when joking about co-defendant Grady getting some of the coke, Mr. Brown asked, "Can I get some for myself?"
But how does this support quantity determinations?
It's a determination that...
Do you agree, by the way, with Mr. Fee that the district judge deemed himself bound by the jury's verdict when he was calculating things for sentencing?
First, I don't agree with that. Second, I think that the district judge wouldn't be bound, but in any event...
No, he certainly would be.
I would direct...
We do need to find out, we do need to know whether the judge deemed himself bound.
I would direct the court's attention to a section of the transcript which is quoted at page 30 of our brief, when the district judge said, "I think the evidence suggests Mr. Brown knew the intended victim of the theft would be a drug dealer and that all the circumstances suggested that the drug dealer's car would contain money in her drugs." And she refused to depart downward because she agreed it was there.
My question has to do with the quantity, right? What you're quoting doesn't say one way or the other whether the district court deemed itself bound by the jury's quantity finding in the special verdict.
I think that the judge did make a finding as part of adopting the pre-sentence report that there was a kilogram brick of cocaine there and sentenced it accordingly. There was testimony before her that there was a kilogram brick of cocaine present. I don't think that's a real issue here, and on top of that, I think the jury's verdict was supported beyond a reasonable doubt by evidence of the record. That might hypothetically be an issue in some case, Your Honor. I suggest it's not an issue here on this record where the brick was before the court. The defendant was a law enforcement officer. There was discussion of two keys in advance and all the circumstances I've discussed. Also, with respect to Mr. Coleman, it's the same story. Again, this was decided by the jury. Counsel wants to take evidence in isolation, but there was discussion of cocaine in advance, and it was clear that he participated in it, and it was discussed again afterwards. On the inextricably intertwined argument, I believe that the trial court carefully ruled to limit any prejudice and prohibited.
Just so I have it clear in my own head, what is the concrete evidence that Mr. Brown knew or agreed in advance to any particular drug amount? I mean, you know, the government has total control over the drug amounts when you have a reverse sting like this one. And the whole thing was a fiction, of course. There are no actual drugs here.
I would say, Your Honor, that the discussion of two keys in advance puts it within the reasonable range for the defendant to expect there to be one key there. I would cite the Estrada case to the court, which is cited in our brief. And when the defendant first goes there expecting it to be a drug dealer's car, there's a discussion of two keys. There's one sham key there, which undercuts any suggestion that the government was manipulating the sentencing amount here. He sees the one key, opens the door to help it go into the car, and then goes away. He agreed in advance. He agreed during it when he helped it go away. And then he joked about it afterwards. It might well be another case if there were 100 keys of sham coke in the car, but that's not this case.
Did you say of shampoo?
Of sham coke.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In the car. But that's not this case, Your Honor. So unless the court has any other questions, we'd ask that the convictions be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Fee?
Just a couple of points, Your Honor, to respond to a couple of things that the government said. First of all, the discussion of two keys. If you look at the transcript of the tape or listen to the tape, it's clearly in the context of a hypothetical. He says, in a typical transaction, an out-of-towner will come into town not bringing two keys, but looking for two keys. So I would say that because of that, it's sort of doubly irrelevant. Now, as far as someone saying that's it when they got to the trunk, I would suggest that, like everything else that you see on the tape of the theft on the 27th, it's completely consistent with Mr. Brown's understood plan to steal money, which independently makes sense and doesn't require the presence of drugs to be meaningful. If he's saying that's it, he expected there to be money. The fact that he saw two brown packages instead of one certainly would not disabuse him of that notion. One final point I'd like to make about the video, Your Honor. If you look at the video at the very beginning, there's a part where they show exactly where the drugs are hidden. They're in a hidden compartment underneath the identically colored money bag, and they're further obscured by the other two men standing in front of Mr. Brown, who never handles either the money or the brown package meant to describe cocaine. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Carlson? Thank you very much. Well, Mr. Fee, Mr. Carlson, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointments in this case and the assistance you've been both to your clients and to the court. The case is taken under advisement.